and welcome to episode 4 of From Paper to Clinic. I'm your host, Dr. Hamza Shah, and today we're joined by Dr. Caleb Abbott. Dr. Abbott is an assistant professor of ophthalmology at the University of Colorado Anschutz Medical Campus. He specializes in ocular surface disease and dry eye, with research interests spanning meibomian gland dysfunction, neurotrophic eye pain, and systemic conditions affecting ocular surface. Dr. Abbott has been recognized as a rising leader in the field, and it's a pleasure to have him on here. Dr. Abbott, thanks so much for joining in today.
Of course. Thanks for having me. It's an honor.
The publication that we're using for our discussion today is called It's Time to Retire the Terms Artificial Tears and Rewetting Drops, a call for accurate terminology and updated clinical usage in eye care. None other than by our guest, Dr. Caleb Abbott, and his partner, Dr. Andrew Pucker. Dr. Abbott, let me start off by just getting your thoughts on why you, what was the inspiration behind this publication? I mean, after reading it, it makes complete sense that we do need this change in terminology.
Yeah, I think a lot of our terminology is 20 to 30 years behind, you know, where the current research stands in the field of dry eye and ocular surface disease. And the term artificial tear is definitely a misnomer. And I think we know that at this point. Really, the definition of artificial tears goes back all the way to 1988 in the FDA monograph, when it was defined and then listed as what you can have as active ingredients and inactive ingredients. And I think our main reason for wanting to write this op-ed on this, trying to explain why this is a bad term, is because I think it's misleading to patients. I think it's misleading to providers. Patients think that they can just go to the grocery store, they can pick up a bottle of quote unquote artificial tears, and this can replenish what your natural tear film is supposed to be producing. And really, that is just not the case. And so I think it's misleading to patients, and I think it's to their detriment in the end.
You know, I can't tell you how many times I've had patients come in and they, you know, come in with their bottle of artificial tears, we call them lubricating drops, and they're like, well, you know, I've been using them 5 times a day, 6 times a day, they don't do anything. And even when you tell them to get these tears, they, you know, they come back frustrated that, hey, you know, they're not doing what they're supposed to do. And that's partially because the terminology we're using, it's misleading them, right?
Yes. Antiquated.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, you know, what some practitioners even do is they're like, oh, that artificial tear is not working. Well, maybe we just need to have you do a different artificial tear. They switch to another artificial tear that doesn't work, and then another one that doesn't work. And, you know, the root cause of the problem is that this is not truly an artificial tear. So maybe we can break down why it's not an artificial tear next.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you went right in it. So you documented the complexity of a human tear really well in the paper, I thought. Can you discuss like how complex the human tear is, the different components it's comprised of, and their functions?
Yes, gladly. So in the paper, we really make an argument that there's less than a 1% similarity between what's in an artificial tear and what is actually in your natural tear secretions. And we also kind of make the argument that this might be the most complex biological secretion in the entire body. When you think about it, what other secretions do you have that you have three completely different glandular systems that are secreting something that are having to form this complex layer? And to break it down further, like if you just look at lacrimal gland secretions, within the aqueous portion of the tear film, there are over 3,000 unique proteins. There's vitamins like vitamin A and vitamin B12 and vitamin D. There's growth factors like nerve growth factor. There's lactoferrins and lysozymes and fibronectins and all of these things that are antimicrobial and all these things that are anti-inflammatory in nature. And we really depend on all of these proteins to provide the nutritional support to the ocular surface and also to help out the corneal nerves as well. And then if you look at the meibomian gland secretions, just the lipid portion of the tear film has over 600 unique lipids and over 90 different proteins. And this is an incredibly complex mixture of polar and nonpolar lipids that are trying to work together, that are trying to prevent those tears from evaporating, that are trying to reduce friction between the eyelid and the globe. And we don't see secretions like this anywhere else in the whole body. So even if you look at sebaceous gland secretions, those are really specialized just to the skin. But our meibomian gland secretions are specialized really just for the ocular surface. And then really the third component that we have is obviously the mucin component of the tear film. There are really two different types of mucin that we have. We have these free-floating mucin that are trying to go around. They're trying to stick to bacteria. They're trying to pull them out. And they're trying to protect our eyes. But then we also have these mucins that are produced by the epithelial cells. And its job is to really hold the rest of the tears to the globe. And we're not even sure how many different types of mucin there are in that portion of the tear film. So it really is this intricate and biologically active mixture that all has to come together, that has to be working in tandem with each other to be functioning very well. And if we contrast this to an artificial tear, quote unquote, you know, it's mostly a lubricant and sometimes a preservative. And there's not much more to it than that. You know, sometimes, you know, companies have gotten creative and they've added things like vitamin C, or they've added amino acids or vitamin B12. And that's amazing. Like, it's great to try to, you know, have further development in this field, but it still doesn't represent at all what we have in our natural tears.
You know, while you were talking, I just thought of the human tears as a rainforest and an artificial tear being a couple plants that we're kind of bringing in saying, oh, this is going to replicate that. This is not going to happen.
Oh, yeah, totally.
But that, I mean, you put it really well. I mean, you know, sometimes even when we're teaching or when we're talking to patients or amongst ourselves, we you know, break down the artificial tear into those three components of mucin, lipid, and aqueous. And I think it's important to realize there's much more there. It's almost like its own ecosystem, and we need to give it that respect.
Oh, yeah. That was stated beautifully.
Yeah. What are some other misnomers in eye care that you can think of so, you know, we can provide better understanding for other clinicians and also for patients?
I think the one that everyone talks about is just the misnomer of dry eye, you know, that dry eye is not dry eye. And, you know, it's funny. I've got a paper that we just submitted. I can't even remember what journal right now, but we are asking practitioners, what are the most important symptoms to you when it comes to your dry eye patients? And dry eye was number five.
Wow. I mean,
like, there's four other symptoms that were more important to practitioners than dry eye, even though we've named the entire condition after apparently what is the fifth most important symptom of it. So that doesn't make any sense, but we all know that. So that's why we've transitioned to the term ocular surface disease, which is a much better term. You know, it's trying to encompass other things that are going on, and aqueous deficiency and MGD and blepharitis and ocular rosacea and, you know, things like that. And I think that that's great. That was a step in the right direction. And this might be controversial to say, but I even think that ocular surface disease is a bit of a misnomer in of itself too, though, because a lot of our patients' symptoms of discomfort don't originate from the ocular surface. A lot of our patients' symptoms of discomfort are actually a peripheral manifestation of a neuropathic pain syndrome. And we know this because there's, you know, the top predictors of whether or not a patient has dry eye symptoms are all non-ocular. Like, the top predictors of whether or not a patient's going to have dry eye symptoms are things like the presence of anxiety and depression and migraines and poor sleep and fibromyalgia and all of these things that are really being governed systemically in the nervous system. And so that's why we see a lot of our dry eye patients. You know, you put proparacaine in their eyes and you say, do your eyes feel better now? And they say, no, like, my eyes are still bothering me. And so we know that a lot of these patients have neuropathic features to their dry eye. And a lot of these dry eye symptoms aren't really necessarily coming from the ocular surface, but are further upstream along the trigeminal nerve. And, you know, the trigeminal nerves goes into C1 and C2 of the spine. So that's where we get the term cervicogenic eye pain. Then a lot of these patients really have problems with the somatosensory cortex of the brain and the pain processing centers of the brain. So they're experiencing dry eye symptoms that are actually non-ocular in nature. So, you know, I think that, you know, dry eye is a misnomer. I think ocular surface disease is accurate a lot of the times, but in of itself can sometimes be a misnomer.
So have you guys come up with a term that's better than ocular surface disease yet, or is that still in development?
That's a funny question. I would say, honestly, probably the most accurate term is really just ocular pain.
Ocular
pain,
okay. Because
ocular pain is not suggesting it's from dry eye. Ocular pain is not suggesting it's from the ocular surface either. It's pretty much just saying pain. But, like, we as optometrists and ophthalmologists have to reconsider what we define as pain, I would say, because, you know, pain should really encompass any ocular dysesthesia, any unpleasant sensation. And under pain, we should think about burning, grittiness, sandiness, foreign body sensation, light sensitivity, even itchiness. So I think we have to think about the term pain differently, but I would say ocular pain's probably the most accurate way to define what we do.
I think you put it really well. I mean, I had a note here, and I completely agree with you. Dry eye is definitely my biggest, it's one of my bigger pet peeves when people are like, hey, this is dry eye, because then everything is dry eye, right? But ocular surface
Totally.
disease, ocular surface disease does provide that more expanded term. But you're right. I think we do need something better, and maybe, ocular pain is what we're looking for. So let's talk a little bit about your approach in just treating dry eye patient or ocular surface disease patients and their management. Misspoke there. You see several dry, or you see many dry eye patients who have severe dry eye or severe ocular surface disease. Ones who may have started treatment elsewhere with primary or secondary treatments. In your opinion, what are some common mistakes that you see in ocular surface disease management?
Yeah, I think there's so many mistakes that are being made, and we're all starting to get better, but we're all learning together too. I think probably the first thing that I think is a mistake is not understanding how motivated the patients are to improve their eyes. So for instance, I have some patients that come in and they have severe symptoms, and you've got type A personalities that say, I just want to try one thing at a time because I want to know what's working. Like, I just want to try this. If that doesn't work, we can go on to this. If that doesn't work, we'll go on to this. And that is a subset of patients. A lot of these patients are so uncomfortable, they don't want that approach. They really want the kitchen sink thrown at it. They want relief. And so I think for a lot of these patients, we have to be more aggressive. We have to be willing to say, I'm not just going to start off with one prescription. We're going to do two prescriptions and a treatment, a procedure. Like, I think in general, people are not aggressive enough in their treatments. And part of it's understanding your patients, understanding how aggressive they want you to be in their treatments and how much their symptoms are bothering them and their personality type. But I think in general, we're not aggressive enough in our treatments. So I think another big mistake that we tend to make is we don't try to figure out the origin of their discomfort. Because, I mean, there's really three, arguably four different types of pain that exists. And the pain that we're all focused on would be nociceptive pain, the pain that is happening from the nociceptors on the ends of the corneal nerves, and that is true dry eye. But you have other types of pain, like neuropathic pain, that's neuropathic corneal pain, but you can have centralized neuropathic pain, something further upstream. You can have nociplastic pain, which is problems within the pain processing centers of the brain. And so what I've had patients that have been treated for years with all of these dry eye treatments that haven't gotten relief, and you go to numb the eye and they don't have any improvement in their discomfort. And in cases like that, you're not going to do any treatment ocularly that is going to help them. Their symptoms of pain and discomfort is really coming from something further upstream. So I think we have to do a better job trying to figure out what is ocular in nature and what is non-ocular in nature.
I mean, that's I you know usually when I'm treating dry eye, I try to identify, first thing I try to identify is what type of dry eye. I think that's one thing sometimes gets lost. We sometimes get tendency of prescribing certain medication, and that's our first go-to medication. I see that quite often, but I always recommend that, hey, identify if it's mainly MGD or evaporative dry eye, and or if it's aqueous deficient, or if it's not dry eye at all, like you're mentioning, if it's pain that's elsewhere. And after
Yes.
that, treating is easy because you know
Yes.
exactly what you're treating. But if you're not, if you don't know what you're treating, then things become a little difficult.
Yes.
What's an underrated treatment in you've seen, or underrated treatment amongst ophthalmology or optometry for ocular surface disease?
That's a really great question. I mean, the dry eye market's so crowded right now. We have so many different things that can help these patients, and that's a be I would say probably the most underutilized treatment, though, in my opinion, is blood-derived products. Be it autologous serum eye drops or platelet-rich plasma. I think there's subsets of patients that this works so well for, and these patients can benefit tremendously from it. It kind of goes back to the tear film. Like, if you've got a patient that's truly aqueous deficient and they're missing those 3,000 unique proteins from the aqueous and they're not getting that nutritional support to the ocular surface, you can literally do something as simple as have them get a blood draw, essentially make them what is actually an artificial tear, and then they can put it on their eyes 4 to 6 times a day, and they can actually replenish what the natural tears are deficient in, the missing lacrimal gland secretions. And that, to me, is truly an artificial tear. So I would say that probably out of all the things, I think blood-derived products are the most underutilized.
In that case, you're talking about serum tears and PRP tears, I'm guessing.
Yes, yeah,
Yeah,
those two
yeah.
options.
I think those are fantastic tools. And I think one tool that's being utilized more now, but I still feel like we're underutilizing are like amniotic membranes. Yeah,
That's a great one.
you get patients with 4+ SpK, 3+ SpK. I mean, they're in severe discomfort, vision is blurry. I feel like it's almost like that reset button. It allows us to get a quick reset button, and then you can go do something like a PRP tier, serum tier, and help maintain that patient's ocular surface. So
Yes, I
I
love
personally
that.
I'm a big fan.
Oh yeah, I use amniotic membranes all the time. Probably do a few of them every day.
Oh yeah. Yeah,
Yeah,
that's
they're
awesome.
great.
Let's end our conversation with this last question. In the last decade, we've had many treatments. I mean, I feel like it's been the decade of dry eye. Many treatments have come out. In your experience, what's been the best treatment in the past 10 years for ocular surface disease?
Feel like this could be like a hour-long conversation. I think
Yeah,
I love that we have different options at this point. Like we have so many different we have the ability as practitioners to really try to figure out, like you said, exactly what is happening at the level of the ocular surface and the tear film, if it's MGD and blepharitis and aqueous deficiency or evaporative dry eye. And we actually have approaches that can, specifically target what is going on. So I don't know if it's been one drug that's been, that big breakthrough. I just think it's been in general the bigger focus on trying to come up with different treatment strategies in different areas of kind of the cascade of problems that we see with ocular surface disease. And I'm a pretty forward-thinking guy. I think in the future, I think the future is very bright for our patients. There's a lot of patients that haven't gotten the relief that they need, and that's sad, and it's impacting their quality of life. And I think in the future we're going to have even better treatments. If you look at the stuff being developed now, it'll just blow your mind. Like the things that we're doing that are trying to focus on like very specific aspects of the corneal nerve, treatments that are further upstream. And so I think we've made a lot of improvement in the last 10 years. We've really gone from one prescription therapy to, I think we're now at like seven prescription therapies, and we have all these different
Insane.
procedures, but I think the future is even brighter.
Well, thanks for mentioning that. I mean, I'm looking forward to what the future holds. I mean, we have combo glaucoma drops. Who says we can't have combo
Yes.
dry eye drops? How about
And there are companies working on that, two that
Oh,
I know of.
that's very exciting. Well, I think that's a good point to end on. Well, this wraps up episode 4 of From Paper to Clinic. Dr. Abbott, thanks so much for joining in and sharing such valuable insights. I hope we can all start to adapt the terminology lubricating drops with our patients and amongst each other. Episode 5 will air first week of July, featuring Dr. Brianna Rue, and we'll be talking about myopia. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join next time.